KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Bullet, it's 9:04.
Generally, the rate of inpatient smoking among schizophrenics is 3 to 4 times higher than the general smoking population.
There's a section of that poster that says if you are having a baby, you may be entitled to additional leave on top of federal law.
You know, we've got a lot of priority work ahead of us with public safety and building community trust, and this just wasn't a priority.
Mayor McGinn telling the Seattle Police Department not to deploy drones. We're going to take that up after 10 o'clock. The Family Leave Act in Washington State, what it means to you, and smoking and mental illness and regulations. We're going to find out about all that as well this hour in the program. But we're going to start with a halted redevelopment plan for derelict buildings at Magnuson Park. It's ended in a $7.25 million settlement. Building 11 LLC sued the city of Seattle. They were the development corporation. After the council revised the development agreement in response from anger from local residents who wanted to see some changes. Councilmember Sally Bagshaw was behind the effort to change the agreement after the local residents and activists protested the development. Sally Bagshaw is chair of the Parks and Neighborhood Committee. Sally Bagshaw, thanks for talking to us.
Good morning.
Where does the $7.25 million the city will have to pay come from?
It'll come from parks, and it will come from the rent and that we will ultimately enter into with a new lease.
So you have to, like, what is it, like you're bonding, you're paying them now, and then you bond that? How do you get the money?
From the city's emergency fund.
I see.
Initially, and then as the new lease goes forward, we'll have to make sure that we're able to get enough return to pay for it.
Now, you had neighborhood opposition. You had the developer suing because the city was asking for changes. They said they couldn't pay.
Can I offer one correction there?
Yes.
The city was not asking for changes. We entered into a lease in 2008 with Building 11 LLC. It was LLC that asked for the changes.
What were the changes they wanted?
They had some technical changes for financing. They wanted to expand the length of the lease from 30 years to 40 years. They had some language that they wanted so that a bank could have first priority in case the LLC went bankrupt.
So you would disagree where it says the city wanted to change some major terms?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I have yet to talk to Lynn Thompson about that, but we'll now.
Because we're looking at the times. Well, right. I'm sure this is lawyers debating too, right?
I don't really think there was much of a debate, to tell you the truth. It was at the end of the day in August of 2011, the LLC had asked us to make these changes. We asked to say, okay, if we're going to reopen the lease, there's some things that we want to look at. And primarily that was on how we were counting public benefits, and we just couldn't reach an agreement.
Well, the opposition was in part because people saw the commercial use that was being talked about and the medical facility use that was being talked about as not in accordance with what the ideas were originally for that area. Did you agree with that?
I think that's exactly what the neighbors were saying. And having Virginia Mason come in there, they felt that it was commercializing an area of the park that they didn't want to see commercialized. And from the standpoint of parks, the opportunity to have a paying tenant in there would allow parks to bring in nonprofit tenants that couldn't pay as much. So everybody was looking for a balance, and at the end of the day, the neighbors made a very good, I thought, convincing case that they wanted to go back and take a look at what that mix of tenants is.
Well, so, when you read a quote from Christopher Williams, who's acting director of Parks and Rec, who says the reality is we may have to look at tenants who are not traditional partners of the Parks Department, what does that mean to you?
Well, I think that's where we're going to have to go next. You know, we would love it if we could have a full house of paying nonprofits, but the fact of the matter is it's going to cost more to operate that building than many nonprofits are going to be able to pay themselves. So we're going to approach this in a very careful manner, but the reality is we're going to have people that can pay for perhaps the second floor. It's going to be a good space, good commercial space, and it's already open right now to allow things like office space up there. That's what's the language of the Sandpoint overlay, but you know, we're going to be really careful about who goes in there.
Well, you had artists in there. You had people who were working on energy-efficient appliances in there. You had folks that were selling boats in there. Those folks are all gone at this point. What sales standpoint is still there, and they'd like to stay there, but their rent was doubled, their space was halved. What's your vision for that North Shore?
Well, that I think is still yet to be discussed, but clearly the sales standpoint's going to be there. There's some opportunity perhaps to bring a daycare in. It would be terrific if we actually had a destination restaurant, places where people could go and stay. I mean, just imagine sailing Sandpoint and being able to get a burger or fish and chips afterwards. I think people are really open to that. And we've heard from a number of nonprofits, including a great organization called Outdoors for All, which focuses on people with all abilities to be able to enjoy outdoor recreation. I think that there's some great opportunities here. But again, this is a regional park. We want to draw people to the park, and we'll just see what comes up. And that's going to be determined here over the next few months.
$7 million to pay out, Sally Bagshaw, when parks are strapped and the city is strapped. Tell me why this is a win.
Well, it's not we're paying out $7.25 for nothing. We get the building that had been some real problems. You know, it was full of not just mold but asbestos and walls falling apart. All of that will be fixed. So the environmental problems will be addressed. The roof will be replaced. We'll have the safety and seismic upgrades made. The historical windows will be replaced, improved lighting. Already that there has been an upgrade to the parking lot. So the LLC has already invested a lot of that. They will get paid back for it. Plus, we will put in the money to upgrade the building. So when the building comes back to parks, it's ready to go.
So additional money besides the 7.25?
No. That's included in that
included.
Number.
So we have a model in a building right nearby where a private gym is opening and a private sports facility is open. Lessons learned from this as you go forward, because there are many buildings in Magnuson Park that will need rehabbing.
Absolutely. And we have to have private partners. There's no question about that. Short of having a massive bond issue, and I'm making up a number here, but let's just say that in order to fix up all those buildings, and it includes the Building 9, which is right along Sandpoint Way, we've got Building 2, which was one of the big hangars, Building 17, 18, which was the old fire station. To actually get down to the point where we could fix those, we're talking, you know, $50 million and up. Parks Department doesn't have that. We'd have to bond it. We'd have to go out and ask the taxpayers to bond. I don't see any appetite for that. So the next step is going to be to include private partners.
Well, we'll see how that plays out, yes?
Oh, absolutely. But the public is involved. We've got a great organization, the Magnuson Park Advisory Council, that will be involved. And I'm excited to think what we can do for a really good regional park there.
All right. Seattle City Council Member Sally Bagshaw, Chair of the Parks and Neighborhood Committee. Thank you for taking the time this morning.
You bet. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. A halted redevelopment plan for the derelict buildings at Magnuson Park has ended in a $7.25 million settlement. The building will be rehabbed, and then it still has to be filled with tenants who can help pay for it. It's Weekday. And now, a moment for the weirder news of the week. And who better to deliver it than Katie Sewell?
True, true. Well, one of the weirder stories of the week came to us from a zoo in London. Strange experiment, really. Can piano music put Galapagos tortoises in the mood to mate? And after this week, we have an answer. The zoo set up a piano.
I would just like to say that she sought this story out.
It jumped out. The zoo set up a piano next to the turtles' enclosure, and the French pianist Richard Clyderman played. And here's the song that the turtles heard.
This is supposed to get the turtles to mate.
Yes.
Because Galapagos turtles, they like...
It's a very romantic song.
I see.
So, of course, the result was absolutely nothing unless you count slow tortoise walking around the enclosure.
I think I do count. That is tortoise mating in a nutshell right there.
So Clyderman decided that he was going to pep things up, so he played this song.
The Chariots of Fire theme? How'd that work out?
Still nothing.
Did they walk a little faster? Well, actually, they walked in slow-mo, didn't they, of course?
Yeah, even slower. No, the only point of interest for the tortoises was when their keeper walked in with carrots.
Now, really?
That was interesting.
This is actually on the scene. You flew there to get the sound of the tortoise eating a carrot.
You'd be surprised how many turtles eating carrot videos there are on YouTube.
I would not.
So it turns out that this wasn't some scientific theory they were putting into practice or a zookeeper's imagination at work. This was just a publicity stunt by Richard Clyderman's record company.
And we fell for it.
Who wanted to advertise that he had a new album coming out. Now, Clyderman himself wasn't too thrilled about this stunt, maybe because it's ridiculous. So reflecting after the stunt, all he had to say was about it was, well, after playing all around the world, it's funny to be here. In a very nice suit.
Yes. Well, I hope he plays. I hope he plays the theme, the Chariots of Fire, with tortoises on the stage for his next big concert.
That would be great.
Yes. Strange news. I think you found it.
Yes.
That's the sound of a tortoise eating a carrot. Next, a look at the relationship between smoking and mental illness in humans. That's in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Regional Heart Center, where patients from the Puget Sound area and throughout the Pacific Northwest region receive multidisciplinary comprehensive cardiovascular care. More information at uwmedicine.org.
41 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle, forecast says. The morning clouds and fog should go away and leave us mostly sunny this afternoon with a predicted high of 46. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:17. The Federal Family Medical Leave Act is 20 years old. Washington State has a similar law, and by combining the two, a woman with a new baby can go on unpaid leave for up to 24 weeks. We'll learn more about that in 20 minutes.
First, though, on weekday, that complex relationship between smoking and mental illness. I'm Steve Scher. A recent study from the Centers for Disease Control has found that nearly one-third of mentally ill adults are smokers. In fact, they're 70% more likely to smoke than adults without mental illness. But the relationship is pretty interesting. The relationship between cigarettes and mental hospitals is complicated. Historically, it was common for mental hospitals to encourage smoking. They even used cigarettes as a reward for patients who were well-behaved. I think we've seen that in various movies and other aspects as well. So we were wondering what that meant for patients with mental illness. And we're going to find out in a few moments because we just lost our connection. Unless you have it back. But we're
working feverishly at the moment.
We are working feverishly. I'll tell you what we'll do through the magic of radio.
Carrots? You want to hear some tortoises chewing? No?
You know, I think that might be good. But I was thinking perhaps we'll play a little music and then we'll talk about the Family Medical Leave Act.
Here it comes.
Okay, I guess we'll do medical leave later. I just took a cigarette break. I don't know about you guys. Pam Bellick is a health and science writer for the New York Times. She also conducts interviews for the Science Times podcast, and she's author of the nonfiction book Island Practice. And she's been looking at the relationship between cigarettes and mental hospitals. She reported on it in the New York Times recently. Pam Bellick, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, happy to be here.
I appreciate you with our phone. We had a little phone issues, didn't we?
A little bit.
Yeah, well, that's okay. First of all, historically, the relationship between mental hospitals and cigarettes, they would use them as rewards?
Yeah, and, you know, it's not really all that historical, actually. I mean, there are some hospitals that still do this, but there's a long history of cigarette smoking being encouraged and supported by hospitals and by advocates for purpose as well, because it was considered something that aided in calming people. Nicotine does appear to have some kind of antidepressant effects, particularly for people with certain diagnoses like schizophrenia. And hospitals would find they could essentially use cigarettes as a behavior modification tool. So they could say, if you don't take your medicine, you won't get to go on this smoke break. Or you know, if you go to therapy, you'll get an extra cigarette. And it became something that was very embedded in the culture, to the documentation of letters that were written by psychiatrists, you know, as recently as 10 years ago, to tobacco companies asking them to donate cigarettes to the hospital because they didn't have the funds to buy all the cigarettes that they needed for the patients.
You know, you also said that tobacco companies used to provide free cigarettes to some mental hospitals. I guess they thought it was a good deal. They thought it was public service.
We were not able to get the tobacco companies to really comment about their past practices, maybe not surprisingly. So we don't know how often they actually fulfilled these requests for free cigarettes. In fact, we have one letter that R.J. Reynolds wrote, this was years ago, response to a request saying, you know, sorry, we can't give you the free cigarettes because we are so overloaded with requests that we wouldn't be able to fulfill them all. It does appear there's some evidence or some studies that suggest that tobacco marketing appealed to people with mental illness. It's not clear how overt that was, what kind of conscious decision that was, but example of a 1986 magazine advertisement for Merit cigarettes that actually said the word schizophrenic in the ad copy, something like, you know, we've got low tar and great taste, and it, you know, you can playing on the idea that you can have personality, so do our cigarettes. So there's some suggestion that the tobacco industry was aware that this was a rich market base.
You know, Pam Balak, I have a question. We're having an interesting telephone dance with you. You cut out every few seconds.
Oh, no.
You're on a landline, right?
Yes.
Usually people don't have to listen to this question. But they'll just have to listen now. That's an odd thing. Is it a landline at an institution?
No, it's not. But it's in the middle of a snowstorm.
Oh, that might be what it is.
Do you want to try my cell phone?
Yeah, we will. But tell me something before I let you go, and then we'll call you back real quick. It's coming down, huh?
It is. We're expecting, yes.
Yeah, lots of feet of snow. All right, I'll tell you what. We have your cell phone. We will we'll call you back on that. We'll call you back in a moment thank you, because we want to talk to Pam Balak about this issue, because the thing that's very interesting about it, and while Andy's dialing, I'll tell you the thing that's interesting about it is that they looked at data about it. They found that 46 million adults with mental illness have a smoking rate 70% higher than those without mental illness. They consume a third of the cigarettes in the country, though they make up one-fifth of the adult population. So folks with mental illness are using cigarettes for various purposes. And I know there are many reasons why that's not very healthy. Nicotine has antidepressant effects. So as we heard, for people with schizophrenia, it can help dampen some of the effects of schizophrenia, the extra thoughts, the voices. But we know what cigarettes do to people. There are other chemicals in cigarettes as well, and the smoke that set them off caused their medications to metabolize faster, makes them less effective, allows symptoms to return. So there's this double-edged sword. And Pam Bullock, back now through your cell phone.
The line is better now.
Yeah, there you go. It is better. It also, there was a report that said that the people who have serious mental illness die on average 25 years earlier than the general population because of the smoking?
Yeah, and this is obviously why this is becoming such a worrisome issue now, because there is evidence that people with mental illness are dying not from directly their mental illness, but that many of them are dying from smoking-related diseases that are taking their lives earlier than the general population, heart disease, cancer, emphysema. And so, you know, people in the medical community are making this connection and saying, you know, we need to deal with this now.
Pam Bullock is a reporter, health and science writer for the New York Times. She also does interviews on the Science Times podcast, author of the nonfiction book Island Practice. Would patches work?
Well, one thing to note is that this population has found it more difficult to quit for a variety of reasons. One is that they just have a long history of smoking, not only for a long time, but also smoking more heavily than many people in the general population. So they've got a higher mountain to climb. And they also have, in general, fewer support systems to allow successful quitting. They're under a lot of stress. They don't have that many resources. You know, they have other issues to deal with, which is one reason why hospitals and doctors have not made this a priority. Now there are hospitals and that have gone smoke-free, and there are smoking cessation programs that are encouraged for people with mental illness. And some of them have been successful, and some of them use things like the patch or gum. Some of them use medications that are supposed to stop or lessen cravings for addictions of all sorts, including smoking. And they can be successful, but it's complicated. And as you were pointing out, there's also this kind of very complicated interaction with medication that they may be taking for their mental illness itself. And what you have is a lot of recurrence and a lot of people, you know, starting up again. And it's not that they really don't want to quit. There are surveys that suggest that people with mental illness really, they know it's bad for them. You know, they want to quit as much as other people do. But it's just tougher.
Now, in Washington State, we learned patients can still smoke at the state mental hospitals, but they have to be outside and they have to be 25 feet from any entrances. What kind of rules are being imposed in hospitals that you were looking at?
Oh, you know, that's interesting. I didn't know that about Washington. But most hospitals that still allow smoking will do something like that. That's also largely because indoor smoking rules in, you know, many, many places, not just hospitals, are, you know, not indoor smoking is not allowed in public places in most places now. So if they allow smoking, it's usually outside. It's usually in scheduled smoke breaks, 3 or 4 smoke breaks a day or 6 a day. And that has sort of pluses and minuses in this situation. You know, on the one hand, it allows the institutions to kind of limit the number of cigarettes per day. But on the other hand, people that I spoke with who work at these institutions or work in mental health say that can cause problems, because if you know that you get 3 or 4 smoke breaks a day separated by several hours and you're really addicted to cigarettes, you might be jonesing for that cigarette during those 3 or 4 hours and getting more agitated as the effect wears off, and you're getting ready for your next smoke break. So that can cause behavior issues. in hospitals, you know, it's not uncommon for patients to try to, you know, do some sort of horse trading for cigarettes with other patients, sometimes even trading sexual favors for cigarettes. So it creates this kind of, you know, underground economy. It creates this agitation. And so if an institution can actually go smoke-free, they found that it can lessen some of those issues among the patients.
Hmm. Pam Bullock is a reporter. She's been looking at the complex relationship between smoking and mental illness and mental institutions as well. Are patients who don't want to go without a cigarette leaving public hospitals for private hospitals? Is that an option?
Well, it is an option, but interestingly, I think that smoking, and I don't have any, you know, there haven't been any national studies to document this, but I found that private hospitals are maybe more likely to allow smoking, because usually when a law is passed, say, in a state, it will only apply to state hospitals. In New Jersey, for example, 2009, after a lot of discussion and some protest by patient groups, they passed a law that said state hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, have to be smoke-free. But private hospitals can do whatever they want. And I went to a hospital in Princeton, New Jersey, where they did actually enact a smoke ban in 2006 with all the best intentions. And then they found that prospective patients were going elsewhere. They were actually losing clientele, and it was affecting their bottom line. And so 18 months after they went smoke-free, they reinstated the smoke ban and the smoking policy. And now patients there can smoke four times a day. They call them fresh air breaks because they're outdoors, but they're going out in the courtyards and smoking cigarettes. And, you know, the director of nursing there said to me, "We are well aware that this is terrible for their health. This puts us in a really bad position as a healthcare facility. We understand this, but we can't really kind of be a going concern unless we allow smoking, because otherwise the patients are going to go elsewhere and we won't be able to operate our business." So it's a really interesting and complicated situation.
But if you call it a fresh air break, you're already halfway there.
Yes, exactly. There was one hospital, actually the hospital that I wrote about in Louisiana, where that hospital doesn't exist in that form anymore. But they were, during an inspection by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals, the inspector said, "You know, really, we don't want you to be calling these things smoke breaks." So they changed the name and they called them fresh air breaks, and that seemed to satisfy the hospital inspectors.
We're talking to New York Times' Pam Bullock. So tell me, at the same time we see this health trend, we see how dangerous adding smoking to people who are already stressed and dealing with other mental and physical issues can be. What are hospital administrators trying to do when they have to comply also with the laws on banning cigarettes?
It becomes a very complicated and gradual process when, for example, in Louisiana, where there was a law until recently that required psychiatric hospitals to accommodate smokers. It essentially said you have to allow smoking. This is a law that had been on the books for years. And anti-smoking advocates pressed to have that law changed. It was changed in, I believe, June of last year, but it's not expected to actually take effect. It's been a long sort of phase-in, and their plan is that by the end of March, they will make the remaining state psychiatric hospitals smoke-free. It takes a long time, in part because not only are patients smoking in these facilities, but often there's a lot of smoking among the staff, and the staff, even in some places, will go out on smoke breaks with the patients. So they often have to, you know, get their staff to quit. Then they have to sort of phase in this idea of maybe fewer smoke breaks. Some of them are using nicotine replacement things like like the patch, they're doing everything that they can, and some are more successful than others.
So we talked about the health implications, then that the complications that come from for people taking medicine when tobacco and the other chemicals are involved. But just to end this once again, what benefit does a schizophrenic get from tobacco and nicotine, and maybe just the act of smoking?
And there's some new science that, you know, just to sort of make this whole issue more complicated. I mean, there is science that suggests that indicates that nicotine has both antidepressant effects; it elevates mood, and for people with schizophrenia, who are probably the largest subgroup of people with mental illness who smoke, some statistics say 75% to 90% of them smoke. It appears to help them focus, help their thoughts focus, and so that they are able to diminish or block out some of the voices that they hear, which is, of course, one of the classic symptoms. So there are people, this is not necessarily an entirely accepted view in the scientific community, but there are people who are suggesting that if we can find a way to deliver nicotine essentially as a medication and separate from the cigarette device, which is, you know, the problems come with cigarettes, the health issues come from the smoke, the tar, and the chemicals, not really from the nicotine. The nicotine causes problems because it's addictive, but it's the other chemicals that are sort of the carcinogenic chemicals. And those are also the chemicals that get in the way of effective of the medication working for schizophrenics and others. So there are people who are looking at that possibility. Is there a way that we can get nicotine kind of approved as a medication, something more sustained than a patch, something more sustained than gum, that could allow people with schizophrenia to sort of have that, I'm not sure you would call it a benefit, but at least to have that kind of effect that seems to help them without having the effect of smoking that kills them.
Fascinating and complex. Very interesting. Pam Bullock's article was in the New York Times. We have a link to it at our website, kuow.org. She is a health and science writer for the New York Times, also at the Science Times podcast, and author of the nonfiction book Island Practice and Hunkering Down in New York Where the Snow is Already Falling. I appreciate you taking the time. Be safe.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm sure you guys are more than used to this kind of weather. And Island Practice, by the way, is being developed into a television series. And at the moment, although the book is nonfiction, the television series is supposed to be fictionalized and possibly based in Seattle. So there you go.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Very fun. That's cool. All right. Well, then I hope when that happens, you'll talk to us again.
I would love to.
All right.
On a better line.
Yeah, all right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take
Bye.
Care.
Bye-bye. It's being developed on CBS, a drama from the folks who gave you Mystic Pizza, and it will be a TV show, which I cannot tell you because I have to watch an ad first. I'll tell you later. This is Weekday.
The ins and outs of family medical leave and how to use it in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Join KUOW and Women in Film Seattle for the Post Alley Film Festival, a day of female-centric short films from around the globe and around the block. Saturday, February 16th at SIFF Film Center in Seattle Center. A reception with filmmakers follows. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
It's a project that was years in the planning, but American scientists have now drilled their way down to a lake way underneath the ice of Antarctica.
We drilled through 800 meters of ice to access a lake water cavity that was about a meter and a half deep.
Coming up on the story, hoping to find life in water that's never seen the light of day.
That's this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, appropriately named KUOW2.
Support for KUOW comes from Cupcake Royale, featuring Valentine's Day cupcakes like smoked chocolate, red velvet, and death cake royale, a chocolate decadence topped with espresso ganache and fleur de sel. Available at 6 cafe locations and metropolitan markets. Pre-order info at cupcakeroyale.com.
41 degrees in Seattle with clouds. Forecast says those clouds should pretty much go away by this afternoon, leaving us mostly sunny with an anticipated high of 46. Speaking of the weather, we're going to find out how being near the ocean affects our weather here in about 20 minutes. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
We learned this week on KUOW that it's the 20-year anniversary of the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act. The act doesn't work for everyone. Janine Sato became pregnant when she was a manager at a North Carolina nonprofit that touted its family friendliness. In Jennifer Ludden's NPR story, she said she was told to return to work after 6 weeks or risk losing her job.
You know, I had a lot of issues with that. I had a difficult delivery. I had a colicky baby. My husband was working. It was very stressful, and I left as a result of it.
Washington has a similar law that's even older. Phyllis Fletcher has been looking at the Washington Family Leave Act. It's kind of exciting that we have an older law than the federal government.
I know. We're so progressive here in Washington state. Yeah, the Washington Family Leave Act first went into effect in 1989, and then the federal law was signed in 93, and it superseded our state law for the most part because it was considered better. And then the state law was updated in 2006, so a lot of times you see it referred to as the Family Leave Act of 2006.
Oh, how interesting. All right, what are the difference? Why did it supersede it? What did we have originally in place?
Well, they're pretty much the same about giving 12 weeks to take care of a family member or when you need medical leave yourself because you're sick. And it basically what it does is protect your job for those 12 weeks. But there are some important differences. And one thing that the State Family Leave Act does that federal law does not is it recognizes what it refers to in the law as state registered domestic partners. So now we call those people spouses, right, for
yes.
the most part. But federal law has not recognized same-sex partners. So that's one way that the state law is different. There are a couple of other differences that have to do with military deployments and births. And so basically, they're similar. The military deployment one, it says, you know, if you're deployed and then you have to take care of a family member, you can use both laws back to back. And the same is true with births. Each law gives 12 weeks of protected leave for the care of a family member. And in the case of a birth mother, it will give you your 12 weeks under the federal law and then your 12 weeks under the state law.
So you get 24 weeks in the state.
You can get up to 24 weeks depending on the circumstances. I asked Elaine Fisher from the State Department of Labor and Industries to break that down a little bit.
Well, the State Family Leave Act must run after the pregnancy disability leave has ended. So this means that a woman who qualifies for the State Family Leave Act will likely have at least 18 weeks of total leave, which is more than is provided by the Federal Family Leave Act.
So, you know, at least 18 and possibly up to 24. That's pretty good.
How'd you find out about it?
The Googles.
The Googles. But how'd you even know
yeah.
to ask?
Well, you know, I was pregnant, and I think what I was doing at the time was just looking for the federal law. And so either based on my location or based on looking up something to do with working at the University of Washington, which holds our license, somehow the combination of what Google knew I was looking for resulted in my getting a PDF from the place where Ms. Fisher works, Labor and Industries, explaining the interaction between these two laws.
You're not getting paid.
No.
And an employer, is an employer required to give you that leave in Washington state?
Yes. Yes. If you work for an employer of a specific size. So there's a whole class of people that are not included in this. If you don't work quote unquote, enough, or if you work for a company that's too small, then unfortunately the federal law and the state law don't protect you in this way. There are other laws that can protect you on a lesser basis, but as far as getting this mega 12 to 24 weeks off, you have to work for a big enough place, you have to have worked there long enough, and you have to work enough hours. So there are people that it leaves out, but there are people that it helps as well.
Why did they initially because it's still out of pocket for the worker, why did they initially decide this was something that was necessary?
That's a good question. You know, I did look at some old newspaper articles when I was getting ready for this, and basically it was seen as a family-friendly type of legislation because it was we were seeing, I guess, in the 80s, a lot of what we still see today of people losing their jobs or having to go into financial distress because of a medical event. So this was seen as something that could help out.
One of the things you discovered is a lot of people in the state don't know about it.
That is very true. It was a total revelation to me when I found out about it. And so and then my anecdotal experience when I was running around telling people about this, other women I knew having babies, the only two people I met and knew who knew about it work in HR law. So it seems like very specialized knowledge. And I asked Ms. Fisher about that as well.
This isn't one of the laws that's well known. That's true. We have it spelled out in bold letters on our poster that there is additional leave for pregnancy. And we hope that people, when they are planning to have a baby or if they are pregnant, will try to find out what their rights are. And if they do extend that effort, then I think the information is pretty readily available.
So you hear her mention the poster. So, you know, all that time you spend hanging out in your mailroom at work and the lunchroom where they have all those posters about stuff you think you already know, like what the minimum wage is and all that kind of junk. There's a section of that poster that says if you are having a baby, you may be entitled to additional leave on top of federal law. That's how people can find out about this, Steve. Or they could just go to KUOW.org, where I've written a handy article for you to go through some of this information.
What if I want to adopt?
Yes. You know, you still get your 12 weeks if you adopt. You would not be qualified for the 24-week extendo leave unless you happen to be also having a military deployment that interacted with your adoption. So it's like yes and no, because the 24 weeks is based on being disabled, quote unquote, by your pregnancy and birth recovery.
I see. How interesting.
Yeah.
Ah, the law.
Yeah. Ah, the law.
So a little news you can use on the Family Medical Leave Act in Washington State.
Yes, on the anniversary of the federal law.
Thanks, Phyllis.
You're welcome.
This is Weekday. All right, and an update on the drones now, if we may. Mayor Mike McGinn has put to bed the Seattle Police Department's unmanned aerial drone program. The cancellation follows a public hearing Wednesday, which drew a lot of public outcry against the program. The question is, though, is our privacy safer now? Ryan Callow is assistant professor of law at the University of Washington. His expertise is privacy and cyber law. Professor Callow, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
So the drones won't be deployed, but what type of surveillance technology is out there today?
Well, you know, there's plenty out there, actually. Everything from just the regular old cameras on the streets, which one day may be coupled with software like facial recognition technology, to license plate readers that routinely look at license plates to see who's in what part of the city. There's, you know, unfortunately plenty of ways for technology to invade your privacy, and I think drones that are up in the air for 10 minutes are probably not the most efficient way to do that.
People were very upset about them. I think in part there's this image we have of the surveillance in the sky, but also people felt they were pretty powerful tools. Are the cameras equally powerful?
I think today's cameras are equally powerful. I will say that there are differences. So, for instance, a camera can't fly over your backyard. And so there are some mobility issues, and there'd have to be an awful lot of cameras in order to have the kind of coverage of a drone. I'll also say, in support of the protesters, that there certainly is very disturbing privacy implications for the more military-style drones, like the Predator B that are used on the borders and are deployed abroad. The particular drones that the Seattle Police Department was looking at are really not capable of the kind of violations of civil liberties we'd be worried about today, but perhaps down the line, future iterations of technology might.
No, these drones couldn't even be up in the air very long, and the police department was saying they were just going to use them for very limited purposes. But go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I think that's right, and I think that I think that the natural use of such a drone would be for situational awareness to keep officers more safe in, say, a SWAT team investigation, or to look for kids who have been recently lost in the park. It's unfortunate that the drone program had to be discontinued, but at the same time, you know, we need to take the civil liberties issues very seriously.
You know, how unique was this backing off by Mayor McGinn on this issue from after pressure from the public?
I don't think it's unique at all. I mean, Berkeley contemplated a no-drone zone at one point, and Charlottesville just in Virginia just passed a resolution against them. You know, I think that the officers are still trying to do a cost-benefit analysis here to figure out whether drones make sense quite apart from the protests. And I think that really serious visceral reaction from the citizenry kind of tips you over the side of, look, we're not even going to look at this technology, which we're uncertain about to begin with. And I think that's unfortunate because of the, you know, many good uses you could put a drone to.
Ryan Callow is assistant professor of law at the UW, expertise in privacy and cyber law. There's a lot of stuff to talk about here, but let me ask you one last quick thing. What's the reasonable legally, what's our reasonable expectation of privacy when we're in public?
Well, that's just it. Today we don't have much of a reasonable expectation of privacy when we're in public. That might be changing. There was an interesting case before the Supreme Court about GPS tracking that suggests maybe we do have something of such an expectation of privacy. But generally speaking, if you're out and about, the officers can watch you. In fact, they can even watch you if you're in your backyard, as long as they can go up in the air and actually be lawfully there. And so, you know, it is interesting that there's very little in American privacy law that would limit the use of drones in order to surveil the public. That doesn't mean that's going to be how they're used, but that is definitely true. There isn't much out there that would stop abuses of the kind we're worried about.
All right, Professor Callow, since we were short of time, and there's so many more issues to talk about, Monday we'll do a longer segment. We'll talk about some of the other countries and also that are dealing with privacy issues, and also some of the other court cases that are involved.
I'd be happy to.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ryan Callow is assistant professor of law at the University of Washington. His expertise is privacy and cyber law. He's going to join us Monday. We're going to talk about some Supreme Court cases. We're also going to talk about, just what kind of expectations should we have for privacy, and what do you think we should have? You could write us now and offer us some thoughts and some suggestions. Weekday at KUOW.org. Mayor McGinn decided that there wouldn't be an unmanned aerial vehicle program in the city of Seattle's police department for now. He canceled that program following public hearing Wednesday, when a lot of people showed up, a lot of people were angry. This is Weekday. And now.
This is the sound of the week.
Now, some of you have been paying attention and even weighing in on the ongoing debate, about Robert Horton's theme song. Robert Horton is our film critic, and he joins us every Wednesday at 10:20 with a look at the world of film. And there's a theme that we play. It's the old Let's Go Out to the Lobby theme with the animated popcorn boxes and the soda cups dancing. And we've been debating whether the song we use is too long. It makes me laugh. But, you know, some people think it's horrible, if it should be shortened or changed. And so far, a lot of people like it. But one Weekday listener, Greg Pecknold, submitted his own homemade shortened version of the theme, which is our sound today.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Yeah, very nice. Nice edit there, Greg. Very nice. Thanks for that. We'll work that in. But you know what? A lot of you are great editors, and there's so much free editing software. Take it to the next step, my friends. You're welcome to submit your own version of that, your own mashup, your own mix, your own whatever you want of that or other things. That's right, a lobby hip-hop remix, as Andy writes. We could do all sorts of things. Or take some songs and sounds and play with them any way you want. You're part of the Phonographers Union, our own Phonographers Union. Guys, we have to have come in again as well. So do some remixes of sounds, play with sounds. We want to hear the interesting sounds you are hearing. Record 30 seconds of something that's going on in your life and then send it to us weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject lines and, you know, what you want to do with the sounds, as long as it's legal, we'd be interested to hear. Now, in the weather here, it's not bad. But in the rest of the country, something to think about. Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works for the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Joins us with a weather outlook for the rest of the day and the week and ahead. Hello, Nick.
Hello. Good morning.
You know, we just talked to somebody from New York. She said the snow was already coming down and they were hunkering down and getting ready. And they're getting ready for what people are calling a superstorm.
Well, yeah, it looks like a big deal, especially in the Boston area. It could be 2-3 feet of snow in some spots. And so this is going to be a memorable event.
Why? Any reason why they're getting such a big event? Any particular, do you know if there's any particular arrangement?
Well, in part, yes. There's a phenomenon called the Arctic Oscillation. And I'm not sure if I've talked about that before, but it basically kind of relates to how much cold air is kind of bottled up at high latitudes versus can get down into lower latitudes. And that Arctic Oscillation is in a phase where cold air outbreaks are favored to the mid-latitudes. And there's a slug of cold air coming in with a nor'easter to coming together for that big snowstorm.
Now, do we have something similar on the West Coast?
Well, we're impacted to a certain extent by the Arctic Oscillation, but it's not as big a player as it is for the eastern U.S. And what's this may not be good news for some of those residents back there, but there's even a chance for another one of these kinds of storms in about 10 days or so.
Wow.
And so I'm going to be watching that.
Wow. And in the meantime over here, some people are thinking winter might be over.
Yeah, you know, while this week today and this weekend looks pretty good, you know, the patchy fog giving way to partly sunny skies, a little cloudy on Saturday, but again, just a mix of clouds and sun on Sunday. You know, you might think winter is over, but it ain't necessarily so.
No, we're going to get a little more. But usually around this time, we get a couple of nice days like this, even a stretch of nice weather, right? And then it turns back to more snow and precipitation.
Yeah, that's right. And so while we're rainiest in kind of early December, and our chances for truly cold air coming out of Canada and snow and all that sort of good stuff is more in late December through January. From now through about the first week of March, while the days are getting longer, the prospects of getting inclement weather don't really change so much. And that's kind of curious, but I think I have an answer for that.
What is the answer?
Well, it's the influence of the ocean. Our prevailing winds are from the west, and the ocean is still cooling off. Its temperatures bottom out over mid-March or so. And so it's just not tempering our low-level air masses as much as it is in midwinter. And so when we have low-level flow off the Gulf of Alaska or the Pacific, it just isn't heated much, and it can be every bit as chilly as it is during the middle of winter.
Yeah. And we know that. Well, so what can we expect for this weekend? What do you see ahead in the forecast?
Yeah, actually a pretty nice weekend. Just a minimal threat of rain along the coast tomorrow, but in the lowlands, you know, maybe a sprinkle or two. But clouds tomorrow, a little more sunshine is likely on Sunday. Next chance of rain looks like Monday night, Tuesday, lingering into Wednesday, but then kind of drying out again. And it doesn't look like they're really going to start getting wet again until next weekend.
All right, I'll take that.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. Pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He joins us every Friday. I believe this is Friday, to talk about the weather and what's happening. By the way, this program, which continues after the news, we're going to have our news in review panel. Joni Balter, Knute Berger, C.R. Douglas is here today. Eli Sanders is off. This show is produced by Andy Hurst, Amin Alsade, Jason Bagano, Katie Sewell, Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. A lot of people put this show together, and you can really hear it, can't you, when we're running around with the phones and the like. Next week, we're going to talk to Dr. Pepper Schwartz on Monday, The Secret to Happy Coupledom. And then she's talking about the big issues that keep couples together. So we thought we'd have a call-in afterwards with you. What are the little touches that make your relationship so much happier? The little things you do for one another. I hope you'll share that with us. That and much more, because on Thursday, Al Gore will be here. We'll talk to Al Gore about all sorts of things. That's all next week. And coming up, the news and reviews. Stay with us.
It's 9:59. We'll have the latest on that big snowstorm hitting the Northeast with a report from Boston in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
It's the anthem of movie land.
Oh, you want me to sing it? Hooray for Hollywood.
The president of the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce is no Beyonce, but you can probably sing it, too.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.